Hello and welcome to your May 17th.
That's right.
Edition of The Talking Show on K-Chung Radio. Los Angeles's most well-rounded micro-broadcasting radio endeavor. My name is, as ever, Steve Akato. And I'm here in the studio with my habitual co-host.
Oh, and it's a good habit at that.
That's right. That's Nicholas Miller.
Hey, yeah. Steve.
And we have a really full day for you guys. So I think we'll let it rip. We've got a large group of people. We've got snacks. There's Zanku chicken going on. There's some white wine. There's some vodka tonics. It's a delightful scene. There'll be lots of merrymaking. Of course, after the last incidents we had with our guest Jim Backus, actually, our union steward cautioned us. So Nicholas and I are both, as they say, designated drivers tonight. So we won't be getting any... we'll be getting our party on with everyone else here, but we have something really special for you, which is a reading of Ladies of the Canyon, which is the first part of the Square Circle story by Jack Levinson, who is a young dramaturge in Los Angeles. So we're going to get right into that, Jack and his group, and...
Hey, Jack.
Right now. And we'll come back after the show, and we'll talk about it a little bit.
It's Ladies of the Canyon from Charlotte Caldwell, the Square Circle story. I've been sitting up waiting for my sugar to show. I've been listening to the sirens on the radio. With Lucy Blagg, Kieran Callanan, Augusta Dayton, Aria Dean, Haley Garrigues, Cecilia Graniarosa, Martha Fernley, Alec Racinos, Lila Porter Follows, Gabriella Ricketts, Gabriel Ross, Jesse Schreck, with special accompaniment by Molly Lewis. I'm Jack Levinson. Tonight's reading is brought to you by The Talking Show, hosted by Steve Cato and Nicholas Miller, courtesy of K-Chung. Let's begin. Square Circle formed in college in the fall of 2003. By 2005, they'd acquired a devoted following. By 2007, they were the biggest name in indie rock. In 2012, following 5 albums, the band retired for good. Along their journey, the four friends encountered artists, critics, fans, friends, and lovers, all of whom affected their course through history. Here is their story. All of their stories. Fade in. Exterior. Gower Street. Evening. A refulgent evening in Hollywood, California, on some warm-aired Monday in 2006, depicted in rich black and white. The streets are quiet, rush hour just finished. A lone figure in a nice tank top and jeans comes toward us on a bicycle down the center of the road. Daniela Clark, 24. A black woman with a distracted expression on her face. She moves quickly, but without great vitality, past the flat walls of Paramount and the adjacent cemetery, past body shops and houses rehabbed into apartment buildings. Finally, the many malls of Sunset Boulevard fill her sightline and she turns right, watching her shadow pivot and disappear beneath each streetlight. We angle up and take one last look at the fade at the edge of the atmosphere. Cut two, interior, Victory Bar, a little later. A black box bar so nondescript it gets to be fancy. The bottles glow, lit from behind. Daniela, Danny for short, tends the bar, waiting on the few customers who are here tonight. Since it's a weeknight, they get to keep the music low. She's wiping down the bar as her co-worker, Lauren Tillman, 21, white and in a similar uniform, enters. She carries a plastic crate full of freshly washed glasses, which she plops down loudly next to Danny.
Sometimes something happens, and it's a small little thing, not that important. But it comes at the perfect time to make it clear that everything in the fucking world is rooting against you.
Wow. What happened?
Did you see the schedule for the week?
Yeah.
Did you see how I'm on it for tomorrow night?
Yeah.
Well, don't you remember me asking Richie a month ago, more than a month ago, if I could have tomorrow off because I got concert tickets?
No, but that sucks. I'm sorry.
I'm not missing this fucking show. I literally can't not go.
Who's playing?
Libby Ames, the folk singer. Do you know Square Circle?
Those are two shapes?
They're this rock band. I don't know. They're getting pretty big, and she's dating one of them, I think. But so she's from LA. This is the last stop on her tour. I've been pretty obsessed with her for a while, and I'm not missing it.
Danny begins to stack the glasses that Lauren just brought in. Lauren turns with a new look in her eye, one Danny's been expecting.
Are you working tomorrow?
I wasn't supposed to.
Cool.
Another beat. Danny keeps stacking, keeps stacking. Lauren hovers.
Would you be, like, opposed to working tomorrow?
You know, Lauren, that would be my 8th night working in a row. I filled in for Maddie on Saturday at the last minute. She got sick.
I know. I'm sorry. I just called her to ask if she could do it, but she's still sick. And it's the new girl's first night tomorrow, so someone else really has to be here to help. Fuck. I just don't know what to do. I have Wednesday off, if that makes a difference.
I'm already supposed to have Wednesday off. I was supposed to get tomorrow and Wednesday off. I haven't had 2 days off in a row since the end of last year.
Right. I just...
Fine, Lauren. Fine.
I'm really sorry.
It's whatever. It's fine. I need the money right now, so... yeah. No problem.
Thank you. Seriously, Danny. Thank you. You just made my fucking week. I'll make this worth your while, I promise. I'm gonna tell Richie.
With a new bounce in her step, Lauren exits. We pull in on Danny, still standing at the bar. Jesus fucking Christ, 8 nights working in a row. 8 nights working and it's still not enough. Fucking Lauren, fucking lazy piece of shit. She never does anything. Thank you, I owe you one. Maybe start by helping clean up instead of standing there saying thank you. The glass in Danny's hand slips and falls, cracks on the bar, scattering shards. Motherfucker. With a wet rag, she mops it up. Deep breath. This isn't fucking worth it anymore. It's just not. The past year has been a lifetime, and it's also been nothing. It's been this. Now her mind arrives at Owen. Really, fuck this place. Fortunately, her phone is dead, so she can't look through the last texts again, which at this point don't feel like they have anything to do with anything. They just said shit to say shit, and what they said somehow ruined everything, and now they just don't fucking talk. She's out of here. She's fucking out of here. She's fucking done. Time for a fucking drink. One part soda, 3 parts whiskey. She picks up a lemon wedge and squeezes it like a stress ball over her glass. The drink clouds and fizzes. Lauren re-enters, finally. Perfect timing, there's nothing left to clean. But there's a stupefied look on Lauren's face. She's pale as a ghost. Her walk has lost all of the delight it had when she left.
Danny.
Lauren, are you okay? What's the matter?
Richie's dead. Richie's lying in there, dead, Danny.
What?
I just found him. I tried to revive him. He's lying on the ground. He's not breathing. He has no pulse.
Danny suddenly feels dizzy.
Did you call 911?
No. Fuck. Call them. Or, no. You man the bar. I'll call them.
Man the bar? It doesn't fucking matter.
You're right.
Lauren has picked up the phone. Danny has to see this for herself. We follow her through interior, back hallway, continuous. A small, grubby hallway lit with fluorescent lights. Danny passes the doors that hold back stocks of liquor and napkinware and heads right for the office door, which hangs slightly open. Nearly forgetting what she's doing, she pushes the door open, revealing interior, Richie's office, continuous. A tiny gray-walled office with stacks of paper and boxes everywhere, a swivel chair, and, sprawled boozily on the floor, the lifeless body of her former employer, Richie Perino, a big fat white guy, 63 until 5 minutes ago. He lies in a puddle of bloody barf, eyes frozen open, slightly crossed. Cash pours in a heap from the safe that hangs open near his feet. Danny props herself against the doorframe.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Jesus fucking Christ. Lauren! Oh my God, Lauren!
Lauren comes running in.
Oh my God.
I know. It's gonna be alright. It's gonna be alright. We're okay, Danny. We're alright. The ambulance is on its way. We'll get everyone to leave the bar and we'll talk to the cops. And it's really, really shitty, but it's all gonna be okay. We're all right. We're all right.
Lauren looks up over Danny's shoulder, examining the stacks of paper and the dead body that lies on the floor. Still rubbing Danny's back, which is slowing its upheavals, she feels a strange sense of clarity. She's done well for herself. Cut two, interior, acting studio, morning. Full color now, an acting class of about 20 people is in session in an empty black box theater in West Hollywood. They wander the room purposefully as loud pop music plays, weaving between one another at various levels of intensity. Their teacher is Diane Travis, mid-50s, an industry vet who prides herself in her indecency.
Fearful now, you repel each other. Okay guys, let's move to the next part of our warm-up. Let's do more repetitions. Olivia, Eric, you first. Come on up.
We pan through the sea of faces, mostly young, mostly attractive, closing in eventually on Olivia Rasmussen, 23, who's visibly disheartened to be called on at this moment. She rises with grudging carefulness. She arrives at the center of the stage, joined by Eric, late 20s.
Okay, you know the drill. Olivia, you are going to respond to the question that I ask you, and Eric, you're going to repeat her answer back to her. You'll go back and forth and watch it evolve organically. No inhibitions. Do not take time to think. We are without social graces here. Olivia, I called you first because I haven't forgotten how much you fucked up last time. Let your fucking guard down or stop telling yourself this is something you're supposed to do. And Eric, don't keep trying so hard not to spit when you talk. If she's in the spray zone, she's in the spray zone. Are you ready? Olivia, how do you feel today? Don't think about it, Olivia. Jesus!
I feel sad.
You feel sad.
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 I 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 feel weak.
I feel weak.
I feel weak.
You feel weak.
I feel weak.
She feels weak.
You! Say you, not her!
I hate you for feeling weak because I want you to feel happy.
Anger.
I hate you for being angry.
Anger.
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 Anger, goddammit, okay? Anger and pain, horrible fucking pain. I'm suffering.
She's suffering, I mean, you're suffering.
I'm suffering.
It's hard for me to watch you suffer.
You're running from me.
I'm running from you.
You're running from me.
I'm running from you.
You're running from me because you don't like me.
I want to have sex with you.
You want to have sex with me.
I want to have sex with you.
You want to have sex with me.
I want to have sex with you.
Want to have sex with me.
I want to have sex with you.
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 You want to have sex with me?
I want to have sex with you.
She wants to have sex with me.
Anger.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
Fuck you.
She pushes him.
Fuck you.
She pushes her.
I hate you. I'm suffering.
I hate you. Because I want you to be okay.
I'm suffering.
I hate you.
You hate me and I'm suffering. Oh my God, I'm fucking suffering.
She begins to cry, covering her face.
I'm not supposed to help her if I don't want to, right?
Cut to interior, Olivia's car, 10 a.m. Olivia drives through West Hollywood, fully calmed down from her exercise an hour earlier. Periodically, the sun catches on her windows, scattering pink spots across the frame that rise and bounce like cells over Olivia's face. As she navigates the roads, she speaks in voiceover.
The further time moves forward, the more fixed I feel in the new person I've become. It's not that I'm thinking entirely new things all the time. It's that I'm now someone who lives looking back on a former self. I live with her and she never changes and I keep growing up. I idealize her while she doesn't know that I exist. She couldn't.
It's what I'm able to conceive of that puts this barrier between now and then. Sometimes that makes me feel a lot of things, but today I'm really just thinking about it. Today's decent. This whole week has been decent.
She turns onto La Cienega.
I'm not in love with anything I'm doing, but I'm learning how to do things even though I don't love them. Seems healthy. I know, at least, that that's what most people ultimately have to do. It's sort of a shitty lesson to learn, but I'm not sorry to be learning it, or I won't be sorry to have learned it.
She pulls up to the storefront of a small boutique, unadorned save for small white letters on the glass doors that read Chemlab Designs. Scout Witecki, 24, stands out front, a small paper bag in hand.
There's Scout. They call her in to work for a few hours, and she asked if I could take her home. Her mom's using the car. We've done this before. It's nice. A quick little catch-up time, like running into each other at our lockers back in the day. It's funny. Sometimes Scout and I really click, and sometimes we don't.
Scout tries the door, and it's locked. Olivia makes a whoops face and unlocks it. Scout enters and sits, with a pregnant look on her face.
Guess what?
What?
A bee. Scout reaches into the bag and suddenly tosses a roll of socks in Olivia's direction.
Free sock, motherfucker!
Oh, hell yeah, for me? Thank you, thanks.
Olivia starts the car. They resume driving, heading north on La Cienega up to Fountain toward Crescent Heights into Laurel. Olivia has to get to Studio City by 11, so it actually works pretty nicely.
So I reflexively said howdy to my boss today.
What?
Howdy. Howdy do. Boss says hi, I say howdy.
What the fuck?
I know, I think I might have gasped right after too, like, what the fuck, where did that come from? I don't think I've ever said howdy before in my life.
Ever.
Ever. And never again. Yeah, I feel like that pretty much sums up my day so far. Or actually, it definitely does sum up my day, because it's literally the only noteworthy thing that's happened. Sucks. How about you? What's new with you?
We're shooting my last scene today, thank God.
Yeah, you've been busy.
I would normally be happy to be this busy, just not busy doing this. I was just thinking about you guys yesterday, thinking, once they see the movie, they'll finally understand, but then I realized that I'm definitely never going to show any of you guys this movie.
No, you have to.
I honestly cannot promise you anything. I hate them. Seriously, I should have quit.
One more day. You're going to Libby's this afternoon, yeah?
Yeah. I've got the shoot, which will be done by noon, and then I've got that target practice thing my therapist is making me do.
Right.
And then Libby's, and then the show.
I can't believe the show's tonight. So fucking crazy. She's so nervous.
Yeah? The whole band's coming out to see it, right?
Mm-hmm. They got here a couple days ago. They're like, here. Did you know that? They live here now.
What? Whoa, so they did decide to.
Yeah, isn't that nuts?
They did that for Libby?
No, I don't think they did it for her. She's for sure part of it, but like, I'm psyched to meet them. It's crazy. They're really good.
I keep meaning to listen to them, and then I don't. I probably should before I meet them.
You'll like it, I think. I was sort of annoyed about the way that they were mentioned in that profile, though. Like, here's Libby Ames, you should care about her because she's friends with Square Circle. Did you read it?
Yeah, of course. I was laughing a little bit, actually. All the references? There was one part that was like classic Libby annoying the shit out of me about how Illmatic just happened to be in the CD she was playing when they started her car. I was like, that's low.
I mean, Libby likes rap.
Libby likes rap, sure, but she also loves that she likes rap. Like, come on.
I mean, whatever. She's talking about this. It's crazy how low people's expectations are for her. An interviewer asked her recently if she knew who Brian Eno was.
That's not, like, that crazy.
Yeah, it is. She's a professional rock musician. I'm sorry, Liv, but you're being unfair. People still ask Libby if she writes her own music. They see her perform and play 15 fucking different instruments and still somehow aren't ready to give her credit for all of it. Or, like, the Square Circle thing. It's constant. If she's a little defensive about it, you know, we're all human.
You're right. That's true. Thanks. I'm sorry.
It's okay. It's okay, Liv.
Would you maybe want to go on a hike between Libby's and the show?
I honestly am going to need to nap at some point before the show. I'm supposed to drive the band there, too, so I think I'm probably going to go home for a second there.
Totally.
But, like, do you need to go on a hike?
No, I'm fine.
Yeah?
Yeah, really.
Okay. Tell me if you feel differently.
I don't.
Okay, but if you do.
15 days into 2006, a NASA aircraft called Stardust returned from a 7-year space voyage, and with it brought the first ever samples of cosmic dust to Earth. A month later, Dick Cheney, at that time the Vice President of the United States, shot a 78-year-old Texas attorney while quail hunting. The attorney, Harry Whittington, survived, and even went on to publicly state that accidents do and will happen, and that's exactly what happened last Friday. In June, Paul McCartney, who at age 16 wrote When I'm 64, would turn 64, and in September, an album called B-Day would cement the rise of Beyoncé Knowles, the leader of the free world. On December 30th, deposed Iraqi President Saddam Hussein is put to death by hanging for crimes against humanity following a ruling by the Supreme Court of the Iraqi interim government. A camera phone video of the execution quickly leaks and is broadcast around the world. The next year, the iPhone will come out. J.K. Rowling will conclude her epic. Square Circle will explode. Barack Obama will announce his candidacy for President of the United States. In October, Radiohead will self-release their newest album, In Rainbows, making it available at the price of the listener's choosing. The findings of Stardust will still be under study. Ladies of the Canyon, Part 1. Darkness. We hear the groans of a floorboard and the turning of a knob. A door opens to let in a small shaft of light, revealing the rather innocuous bedroom of a teenage girl. In steps a young woman, carrying a lantern in one hand and a stuffed bunny in the other. She's Haley, 22, and right now she is panicked.
Susie, I didn't mean to reject you. I know Mom and Dad have always kept you locked up in this house, so I wanted to try to be the best sister I could be. Susie, I was only trying to be a good sister. Are you there? Susie, are you there? Were you ever there? Where am I? Have I been dreaming? Have I gone mad? Am I alone? Have I always been alone? All alone? Oh gracious, oh gracious. It's always been me. It's always been me. A sister with no sister. A sister running mad. A lie. A dream. It was all a dream. Oh God, good Lord. It was only a dream. It was only a dream.
She continues to whisper to herself, and as she does, the figure of a possessed girl, 16-ish, slowly rises behind her.
It was only a dream.
Or was it maybe a nightmare?
Haley shrieks and leaps up, but the girl blocks her way.
I'm paralyzed with fear, positively paralyzed. My bones bind as they're glued together, unable to move. I quake. And quaking, I pray, I...
The girl leaps on her, biting into her shoulder. Haley spews blood all over the girl's face.
No! No! Why? Why me? Your cherished sister? No, don't eat my flesh! No, you're eating me! She's eating me! Alive! Why, God? I think the blood punch ran out.
Fuck. That's a cut.
Someone pulls a shade from over the windows, revealing that it's actually bright midday, around 12:30 p.m. The possessed girl, actually a 24-year-old actress from Tarzana named Leia Epstein, steps away from her. Their director, Willie Blau, 25, and their cinematographer, Zeke Silverman, 25, appear.
Yeah, it's totally empty.
Okay, next time you gotta just run with it. We can't keep reshooting.
You know, it's actually so dark in the shot that you can't really see the blood very closely anyway.
Well, that's a problem. It should be light enough to see.
I mean, it's light enough to see, but it's still really fucking dark. It's dark enough that you can't tell it's a different actress than the whole rest of the film.
So no one's gonna know it's me.
If it goes well, they won't. You're not supposed to be able to tell.
You sure can't reshoot her other scenes?
No, that's the entire movie.
Yeah, we just explained this to you. It's the one scene our lead didn't film. You'll get paid, people will see your face. But we have to make it look like it's her.
Okay.
Leia.
Oh. Hey, is there a way for us to use a different kind of blood? I'm hypoglycemic, and this particular type of fake blood is, like, really sugary, I feel like.
So, a few notes, since we cut anyway. But I want this to be our last take. Haley. For one thing, cut that weird monologue about being paralyzed. You're not supposed to say anything there. Maybe an, oh my God, or something, but nothing about your bones being made of glue or whatever the fuck. It's more. And also, don't open all the bureaus and look for her. It doesn't make any sense. She'd obviously never fit in one of those drawers.
And were you feeling like it was hot? Like, I feel like it could have been hotter.
Yeah. Could have been hotter. It needs to really call the rest of the film into question.
You mean the parts I'm not in?
Yeah. So when she attacks you, it's...
It's almost what you want.
Yeah, it's like cathartic.
It's a release.
Yeah, totally. It's a release for you both.
And for the viewer. I mean, a perverse release.
Yeah, totally perverse.
Okay.
Well, I do think on this take we should, yeah.
Ah, you're right. You're right. So, Haley, we've thought staging the scene so that she actually takes your dress off.
Or the top of it, at least.
Yeah. Maybe the top of it. Maybe all of it.
For how much extra? I'll take the whole thing off for $100, but I need it up front.
That's a lot. Better than I thought she'd ask for.
Shut up. Yeah, okay, we could do that.
Let's take it from when you're crying on the floor. Everything before that was good enough. We have like 20 minutes before my shift starts at Urban.
Okay, let's go. Go, go.
Haley returns to her position on the floor.
I still have the blood on me.
Yeah, whatever.
And action.
It was only a dream. It was only a dream. It was only a dream.
Or was it a nightmare?
Ah! No, no, all this time I was right, dead right about you. And now I stand in the room we once shared, trembling as I see your true nature, the evil I've always known to be within you ever since we played together as children. So close, so very close.
Shut up!
Leia attacks her again.
No! Ah, you're eating me alive! Eating me! No! No, yes! No! Don't stop! No, you're eating me. Stop! Stop!
Leia keeps attacking her, fumbling a bit as she tries to figure out where the zipper is on Haley's dress.
No, no, stop. Do you like the way I taste?
Kind of.
No.
Back to interior. Victory Bar. A little later. We return to our black and white footage. The same bar, now empty and with the lights on at full blast. Denny's trauma has stewed into a stunned, stunted static. She smokes a cigarette at the bar. Lauren pours whiskey for both of them.
That's not totally fucked up. 25 minutes for 911.
Should I, like, call again?
Yeah, check on your order? It's fucking absurd.
Here's your liquor. Wait, Danny. I actually didn't call 911. Yeah.
Okay, you know what? That is so uncool and not funny at all.
It's not a joke is the thing. Yeah, I didn't call 911. Because, okay, I was thinking about something.
Danny freezes, aware that she's experiencing something other than reality and trying to figure out what it is and why it happened.
Danny?
Yeah?
I guess I was just realizing... So this is, like, maybe sort of an opportunity in disguise.
What are you talking about? Did you really not call 911?
Yeah, nah, I didn't.
How'd you get the customers out of here so quickly?
I was like, yo, guys, time to go. We're shutting down early. Sorry. Like, andale, andale.
Did you really not call 911?
I didn't, Danny. And if you ask me again, I'm going to do something.
Danny gulps down her drink.
Come this way. Come on. Come with me. We're fine.
Interior. Hallway. Continuous. Lauren leads Danny back to the entrance to Richie's office. She's opening the door.
Lauren, stop. I don't want to go back in there.
Really quickly.
Why?
They look at each other. Finally, Lauren turns around, swinging the door open. Danny stands at the entrance, looking in. Interior. Richie's office. Continuous. Lauren steps over Richie's body, which Danny tries to avoid looking at. She swings open the safe all the way and begins to sweep all the money out of it.
What are you doing?
Lauren swiftly turns to open another cabinet, revealing another safe. She enters a number in it, and it quickly unclicks, revealing that it, too, is full of cash. Lauren again sweeps all the money out of it so that it goes flying everywhere.
Lauren, stop.
Lauren crosses the room so that she's no longer standing over Richie and now opens another cabinet, revealing three more safes. One after the other, they swing open, revealing more mountains of cash. One, two, three.
Had you known how much fucking cash Richie just keeps locked up in this office? Or kept, I should say. He must have been up to something. So sketchy.
She flings the money from these safes too, allowing it to fall in leaf-like piles around Richie and his frothy discharge. Danny feels that the room is spinning around her, and strangely, that the only fixed point is Lauren, who stares at her with the same slightly bewildered expression she always has. This is a dream. This has to be a dream.
Okay, so don't judge me, but I have the codes to get into the computer for cards.
Lauren, we just need to call 911. We can't just be standing here when...
When what? When what? He's dead, okay? Like, dude's dead.
I don't want to steal from someone who just died.
Why not? Better than stealing from someone who's still alive. And you're broke. I know you're broke because we get paid the same amount of money because I know you have debt. And I'm in debt too, Danny. I need this. And come on, Richie, like, sucked. Are you sad? Do not tell me you're sad.
I'm not sad, I'm freaked out, okay? It's fucking scary to be in here with you telling me you want us to steal from someone whose dead body is face down in a puddle of vomit.
Sure, but get over it. Seriously, like, you've gotta get over it. I'm offering us freedom.
Don't you realize we'd be the first suspects? The people who were working when he died and cleared out the bar but didn't call 911 would be caught immediately.
Not if we ran.
They look at each other. Danny's beginning to lose all awareness of her body. This bar is nothing more than a set at the end of a production, waiting to be struck.
This is a dream, Danny. Just go along with it.
Oh.
Smash 2, interior, Lauren's car, a little later. Lauren at the wheel and Danny in the passenger seat hurtle down Alvarado and Lauren's gray Saturn, whose license plates they've removed. In the back seat is a whopping $84,175 in cash, 7 safes worth of money.
Holy shit!
I know!
Woohoo!
Ow, ow,
suck my king-size dick, motherfuckers! Let's get some tunes playing.
Danny turns on the radio. The perfect song comes on. They cruise through stop signs, past frozen pedestrians who watch the headlights switch to taillights with scornful envy, the cash starting to flutter in the back seat, into the shoes they've taken off, one lone 20 grazing at the window as they swerve, ecstatic, around other slower cars that are still within the system, and ascend into the infinite embrace of the California 2. Time passes. The 2 becomes the 5, becomes the 134, becomes the 101. Calabasas becomes Galetta, becomes the middle of nowhere, becomes somewhere called fucking Prunedale. The sky washes warm around Gilroy, and they have not stopped driving. In San Jose, they stop for gas. The sky goes bright, and they continue their charge by daylight. For some women, reason their young women aren't scared. Instead, right now, they perceive themselves to have initiated some magnificent spiritual journey, united on a mission toward perpetually unveiling a formerly undiscovered truth of what the world can hold for people. They drive defiant in their optimism, enamored of this rebellion, in love with who they see themselves to be, and now the black and white dissolves into glorious technicolor. It's 12:30 p.m. on Tuesday, and every second getting deeper in the dream.
Lauren?
Yeah?
Did you kill Richie?
No. Did you kill Richie?
What? No.
I believe you.
Offices of Bridget Hughes Stern.
Cut to interior. Offices of Bridget Hughes Stern. 12:30 p.m. Natasha Kenny, 24, sits at the reception desk in the West Hollywood offices of Bridget Hughes Stern, publicist to A-list actors, directors, musicians, comedians, and the occasional politician. It's a plush, inviting office, like a hotel with desks. Natasha sits at a new iMac, 2 cell phones at her fingertips. At present, she speaks on a third.
Hello. Offices of Bridget Hughes Stern. This is Natasha. May I ask who's calling? Ross? Oh, Ross! How's it going? We were talking at the... Yeah. How are things? No fucking way. That sucks. I'm sorry. Damn. That's... No, we're fine over here. We're chilling over here. Me? Can't complain. Well, I can complain, but I'm not gonna. Anyway, though, Bridget's not here right now. Ross, so... Wait, what? You're calling for me? Well, in an hour, I get to run home to pick up my lunch, but I'm not off till 6. Tonight is my best friend from high school's concert, and then I'm hosting the after party. Actually, after having a fucking brain shart and offering up my parents' house. Why do you ask? Wait, really? Are you punking me? No. I'm not opposed at all. At all. Yeah, drinks sound great. Cool. Yeah, talk to you then.
She hangs up, looking around the room, reacting to what's just happened. Now, Maya, I'd like you to read the stage directions during this next article.
The Road Leads Home by Maya Sotelo. It's 11:15 a.m. on Laurel Canyon Boulevard, and traffic is at a complete halt. A serpentine line of cars weaves up the canyon road as far as the eye can see. I'm as cranky as everyone else. I'm 15 minutes late and low on gas for what's supposed to be an adventure all over town. My companion is to be Libby Ames, the 24-year-old folk musician whose 2005 debut album, Mission Street Silver, catapulted her to the status of a bona fide cult figure overnight. After a year of touring in the U.S. and abroad, Miss Ames has returned just days ago to resettle in her hometown, and the last stop on her tour, a homecoming gig at the Orbit Theater, is just 5 days away. It's close to 20 more minutes before I arrive at Ames' childhood home, where she's staying for the time being. I'm crafting my apology as the sudden wooden gate to the driveway slides open, but as I pull through, I forget the previous hour altogether. The driveway descends to reveal a sprawling ranch house estate. Dusty and gracious, with white painted wood and cheerful yellow shutters. Animals are everywhere. Dogs, cats, chickens. At the top of the staircase stands Libby Ames herself, waving warmly, lovely in a blue button-down dress. Before I have time to apologize, she beats me to it.
I am so sorry. I completely forgot to tell you about the shortcut.
We shake hands, and I explain that in addition to being 45 minutes late, I'll also have to stop for gas.
Oh, I can drive,
she says, turning back up the stairs to retrieve her keys. But it's a lot of driving, I start to say, to which Miss Ames shakes her head.
I think I can handle it.
She's got a point. In 2004, Ames took off on a year-long road trip across the United States. All she had were two suitcases, five instruments, and a plan to emerge with.
Something. I was gearing up to take this trip for a long time. But I really waited until I was sure I could make the most of that kind of experience. There was more than a year beforehand when I kept asking myself, can I do it now? I took spring semester off of my junior year of college, and I decided not to go back in the fall. Finally, I felt like I'd reached a point in my creative life when I could handle that kind of independence.
For many, this attitude might lead to disaster, or worse, to nothing at all. But for Ames, that road led to Mission Street Silver, an astonishing collection of songs with a distinctly existential thread of questioning within them. Each song tells a story, seemingly belonging to its own character, but some songs seem to refer to the same incidents and the same motifs.
I became obsessed with the tension between permanence and transience on the road. Each moment is totally indebted to the preceding moment, but all of it, the whole, like, string of moments, is intensely predetermined. The road was built in full before I left home, you know, my family home, the apartment I was just staying in New York, the creek in Hamilton, Montana, where I camped out for a week. All of those places are connected to each other and always have been. I never used to think, driving by downtown, about the fact that those same 101, that same 101 also passes through those unbelievable stretches of Humboldt County at the same time. It's in both places at the same time. An album's the same way. It feels like a journey, but it's prescribed. It's already all there. You wonder if anything you're experiencing is actually new.
Ames's music, which often involves banjos, mandolins, and even in one case, a zither, harkens back to an earlier era of American folk music. But she's full of surprises as she revs up her car, a new red Prius. The speakers blast with familiar rap music. Is that Illmatic? She laughs.
I was in a New York state of mind.
The playlist remains eclectic as we descend through Laurel Canyon. It's beyond fitting that Miss Ames should have grown up in this hallowed neighborhood of myth and music. Laurel Canyon in the 60s was something like California's answer to the Chelsea Hotel. It was where Joni Mitchell wrote The Circle Game while gazing out the window. Carole King lived up the street. Graham Nash would stop by, and Jim Morrison and James Taylor. Even then, the streets were full of secrets. Houdini had lived here. Nobody knew quite where, and some houses were rumored to contain secret cave-like tunnels into Prohibition-era speakeasies. It was in its heyday that Libby's own father, the legendary comic book artist Rob Ames, settled and made a name for himself. And he's hardly left since. We get food and coffee at a table at the fittingly named Trails Cafe in Griffith Park, a sunny outdoor food stand at the base of multiple hiking paths. We discuss a whole range of topics, from the world tour she just concluded to the rise of the mashup.
I'm into it.
She says about the emerging genre of dance music.
It's funny, people always seem surprised that I like mashups, that I like hip-hop, that I like music that isn't made on the instruments, on the totally dated instruments I play. But obviously I do. I'm 24 in 2006. I grew up with Radiohead and Janet Jackson on the radio, not, you know, blind Willie McTell. In high school, I had a big Boards of Canada phase, you know? I think something people don't always understand about revivalism is that I'm actually very aware of the context in which people are hearing my music. I think they think I'm just looking backward, but I'm not. I'm experimenting with my place in this tradition, and as a woman. I'm doing this from the vantage point of right now. See, there's another road, the road paved by tradition. I always wonder how inevitable what I make is.
The intensity with which Ames is thinking about our place in history seems to explain a recent affiliation with the upstart indie rock outfit Square Circle, a Brooklyn-based ensemble who in the last year have catapulted to notoriety for drawing influences from all over at the expense of their own individual voice. The rockers have frequented Libby's shows in cities all over the world, and speculation has risen that Ames might be dating one of the band's two chief songwriters, though no one is quite sure which one. About that, Lily is tight-lipped, offering only...
I love Square Circle, on stage and off. They're my new dudes. It feels like there's something we're sharing right now. Solidarity, man. I promise them our first stop is El Coyote.
I go for it. Are you dating one of them?
I'm really excited to take them to El Coyote.
Exterior, Olivia's house, 1 p.m. Olivia parks her car in the driveway and ascends the steps to her house, a large, deep green cottage-style home with white shutters. We watch from a distance.
When I was 12, a mom at my new middle school approached my parents about casting me in an episode of a TV show. It was a crime drama. I was going to play some tween who'd been abducted and had all this fucked up shit happen to her.
Olivia arrives at her front door and unlocks it, disappearing inside. Interior, Olivia's house, continuous. Olivia passes through a darkened entry room and immediately into the living room, a stately den with dark painted beams across the ceiling. Along the nearest wall is a bookcase lined with framed pictures.
My parents said no. I was so upset. I'd really wanted to do it. They told me that you only get one chance to be a kid and that if I still wanted to act after I graduated from college, that'd be when we'd start talking about it.
We zoom in on one of the framed pictures. It's a 13-year-old Olivia and a lineup of girls all dancing in poodle skirts. Their face is almost reflective with makeup. She's frozen in song, her face preternaturally poignant. Olivia's voiceover continues as we begin to pan across. These are all photos of Olivia performing. At 15, in cartoonish patchwork overalls, her hands on her hips, guffawing, one tooth blacked out. At 18, as Rosalind in As You Like It, smiling charmingly in a fake goatee.
At a certain point, I got really good. It was a thing. I was my high school's leading lady. I was really good at school, and I was really good at acting. It was the same in college.
An 18-year-old Olivia in a billowing 19th century dress, hair piled up above her head, at a table surrounded by people in similar outfits. A 19-year-old Olivia in a dirty nightgown in front of no set at all, holding a cigarette, exhaling a stream of smoke turned electric pink in the stage lights. A 20-year-old Olivia in a man's button-down shirt, without any makeup, gazing impenetrably into a mirror.
It was exhilarating. It was so unbelievably fun.
We arrive now at the final framed picture. 23-year-old Olivia's headshot, in soft colors, eyes locked with the camera but fresh, somehow, as if caught off guard. Smash 2. Exterior, Olivia's pool. A few minutes later, Olivia bursts out of the water, splashing everywhere, liquid orbs warping the light-flooded patio in the background.
It's strange. I've known I wanted to act for my entire life, but what I love about acting is that each new part completely resituates my existence in the world.
She submerges herself back under the water and we follow her. She flips upside down, kicking her legs back and forth to stay down. Through the screen of the surface of the water, the light flattens and bends, aqua blue and gold. She puts her foot through it.
I haven't had that in a while. Maybe that's the whole problem. I'm bad at being just me. I would go method on a commercial at this point.
She flips back over and swims forward, under her own upside down and undulating reflection, which she collides with as she pops out of the water again.
Quick thought.
Cut to exterior, Scout's porch, 1 p.m. A snug, elegant courtyard in a West Hollywood duplex. This is where Scout Rutecki and her family live. Scout sits at her MacBook, typing, a cached bowl next to her.
Sometimes my life feels like a Woody Allen movie.
And sometimes my life feels like an episode of The Office. And sometimes my life feels like footage from a documentary that was cut out of the movie immediately because it was so fucking boring.
Cut to interior. Scene of Scout doing something really boring. Scout's voiceover laughs. Fuck. What should this scene be? She should be really fucking stoned in it. Like, blatantly stoned and doing something unbelievably boring. Something that makes being really stoned look really shitty and awful. Parked in traffic on the 101 by, like, that mirrored glass car dealership near the Barham exit is too obvious, but along those lines. Being at work wouldn't make sense. Same with being in a waiting room. Something will go here and it'll be funny. Back to exterior, Scout's porch. Scout is now welding a car. Back to exterior, Scout's real porch. Scout sits laughing at her computer, imagining herself welding a car. She sighs and resumes typing.
But actually, it's sort of nuts how fucking closely tied my experiences are to the culture I consume. It helps me understand the tone of each moment as it passes. It casts time, if that makes any sense. I think it's harder and harder for writers to convey experiences that haven't already been introduced to us. Even banality at this point has always been communicated pretty well. Libby always disagrees with me about shit like this.
Cut to exterior, Redwood National Park, day, 2 years earlier. A lush, densely wooded trail, wondrous in the golden afternoon sunlight. Her voiceover continues.
I always think about this conversation we had a couple of years ago.
We pivot, and into our sightline come the smiling faces of Scout and Libby, both 22 in flashback. Libby is but 2 years away from the release of the debut album that will establish her name. She's visibly, contagiously thriving. The young women pass a joint back and forth.
I guess I think that for artists, and for women artists especially, there's a particular responsibility to say something in a new way. Because the reality for you and me is that no matter what we make, we'll always be seen as the women who made them. And my feeling is sort of like, okay, if you're gonna tell me I'm so different, world, then I'm gonna say something that seems like a man could never have thought it up, you know? I'll make work that shows how underexplored and cool that experience is.
Yeah, but like, I think you can't try to make your work that if it's not that. Like, you happen to have a very particular set of influences and a very particular vision of the world in a way that you've always wanted to communicate about it, which is chill as fuck. I think that's awesome. That's not really how it is for me. Like, I feel like it would be sort of disingenuous if I were getting in the way of what the world feels like for me, just so I could be more of, like, a woman with a capital W. That's not what I'm saying you're doing. I'm just saying if I wrote a really good screenplay that felt like a Martin Scorsese movie, I think that'd be okay. If I believed in it. Like, if I threw something away just because it didn't have a really strong, foregutted feminine voice, that would mean I was buying too much into gender roles too much, you know?
I get what you mean. I think this is out.
She drops the stub of the joint on the ground.
Did you ever join it with us?
Huh?
Olivia and I used to have this thing we do called joining it. I thought you might have done it. It was when we'd be confronted with some sort of extreme circumstance, and rather than trying to, like, mitigate it, we'd just embrace it and try to make it more extreme. There was this one day summer after senior year when it was insanely fucking hot out and we were about to go swimming, but instead we made hot water with lemon and got in the jacuzzi. It was weirdly awesome.
That sounds absolutely horrible.
No, for some reason it was really refreshing. I don't know what just made me think of that. I hope she's okay.
You should call her.
No.
Back to exterior, Scout's porch. Scout remains at her computer.
I have no idea what I'm trying to say.
She looks at the screen in front of her for a moment and then snaps it closed without quitting anything. Cut to exterior, rest stop, 1:15 p.m. Lauren's gray Saturn pulls into an otherwise empty parking lot on a quiet, wooded stretch of the 101. Danny's opening the passenger door.
I'm just gonna wait in here.
Okay.
She gets out of the car, closing the door behind her, and begins walking to the bathroom. She didn't think about it. She just did it. She just closed the fucking door of that car that's still running with this crazy fucking girl inside it who might have killed someone and is probably about to fucking drive away while she's in the bathroom. No. This is a dream. She enters the bathroom. And as an A-frame ceiling that casts a mutated square of light onto a concrete floor, a weirdly pleasant rest stop. Maybe it's an attempt at an apology from Lauren. Sorry. At least it's a nice bathroom. The fan is running and the walls are thick and she can't hear anything outside. It's impossible to know if Lauren has left her. It's impossible to know whether or not this is a dream. Danny looks at her reflection.
Last night when I was cleaning, a glass broke in my hands. It got all over the countertop, so I wiped it up and went back. When it looked like I was done, I turned the rag over and started trying to pick out the biggest shards to throw them into the trash. But after a second, I stopped. Why was I doing this? It was a rag. I threw the whole thing away.
She remembers Lauren and feels a jolt of panic. She has only one more second to think.
I can't be alone. I cannot. But she can't know that I feel that way. She needs me too. I need to remember that she needs me too.
If she's even still here. Danny grimaces, watching her breath. In. Out. She just needs to go outside and see. In. Out. In. Finally.
If she's still here, then I know that she needs.
She walks to the door, pulling it open, eyes flooding from light exposure. She squints, covering her eyes. When she walks outside, the car is still parked out front, music playing through the open windows. Lauren has moved to the passenger seat, from which she smokes a cigarette.
Do you mind driving for a little?
She dangles the keys out the window for Danny to take. Cut to... Interior. Natasha's car. 1:15 p.m. Natasha cruises up Laurel Canyon Boulevard in her Mitsubishi, music blasting. The sun is shining and the streets at this hour are pretty empty. Before she knows it, she's reached the windy part of Laurel. Fun to drive when no one's on it. Yes, yes, yes. The world is saying yes. She wonders where she and Ross Perloff will go on their date. Amazing that Bridget doesn't represent him anymore. It makes it totally okay for them to bone. He's so fucking funny and sweet and covertly really hot. It's so funny though, he had sort of seemed like the kind of guy who... Fuck. What was that? She ran over something. Was that a fucking cat? Did she just hit a cat? She pulls over and gets out of the car. Afraid of what she's about to see. Walking a few feet behind her, she sees... Oh, fuck. A roadkill animal. Certified fresh. Its blood in a trail from her car wheel to its carcass, which is an incomprehensible mass of fur and blood, ripped skin and pink muscle. Slimy. Evil-looking. Just sitting there. She gets close enough to see it from another angle, spotting a white-furred paw.
Oh, God.
She inches closer, against her own will. Cut to interior comedy club night. Natasha, in a cocktail dress, stands on stage with a microphone lit by a spotlight.
So I'm looking at this, whatever it is, I just ran over with my car, and there's starting to be a little bit of traffic pile up on Laurel Canyon Boulevard, because people are trying to get around me, and I'm feeling so terrible when I hear meowing. The cat was still alive. So I'm standing there like...
Back to exterior Laurel Canyon Boulevard. Natasha stands about a yard away from the cat, looking between it and oncoming traffic, which she occasionally directs around her car. Her monologue continues in voiceover.
Just like, what am I going to do? And I'm wishing, honestly, that someone is going to drive up and run over the cat again. But because I'm standing there, and my car's got the hazards on, everyone's driving a good distance around us. And I just realize, I'm going to have to rerun over this fucking kitten. It wasn't actually a kitten, I don't think. I think it was a full-grown cat, like 50% sure.
We follow Natasha into the car, holding on her face as she reverses. She pulls back once and then forward, and then a second time, a third time, a fourth time. Now she departs. Back to interior, comedy club, night.
That's like, there's the story. Oh my God, this is the shittiest thing ever. This is actually among the top most degrading things that have ever happened to me ever. It sucks so much. This one time I was walking my mom's assistant's dog through my neighborhood because he was really busy and I was like, I don't know, I had nothing else to do.
Cut to exterior residential street, afternoon. Natasha, in her sunglasses, walks a dog down a quiet street in her neighborhood. Her story continues in voiceover.
And it's a lovely afternoon. This is probably 2 years ago at this point. And we're walking around. This dog is named Lula and she's this ancient corgi. She can't even really walk more than, like, two blocks. And Okay, so I could lie and say that I'd already picked up her shit and thrown out the bag, but I'll tell the fucking truth. I didn't bring a bag with me to pick up the poop. I'm a fucking dick, okay? But so this dog is going to the bathroom, and she's taking her sweet fucking time going to the bathroom, and I'm standing there, and I remember thinking to myself, thank God we're in such a quiet area, you know? And it's like the middle of the day, so this dog is close to done pooping, I can tell. She's starting to kick up the grass a little bit behind her when this car comes around the corner.
A BMW slowly comes down the street toward Natasha. On screen, Natasha's face turns serious.
And I'm telling this dog, like, you're not done shitting. Just keep shitting till this car passes so it's not clear that I'm not planning on picking up after you. This dog proceeds to fucking sit down next to where she just took a dump and is sitting there, like, panting from the strain of it. And I look like such an asshole because it's totally obvious what I'm doing. But also, like, whatever. If I saw someone doing that, I'd be like, word, oh well, c'est la vie. But this car decides to pull up.
The BMW stops directly next to where Natasha stands.
And the window rolls down and it's this woman.
A shocked woman in expensive attire sits at the wheel.
Who goes,
oh no. Oh no. Nuh-uh. No fucking way. Are you serious?
And I go,
unbelievable. You should be ashamed of yourself.
And I don't know what to say. She pooped earlier. I already threw out the bag.
I have extras. I have extras right here in my car.
So then I have to act all relieved. Oh, perfect. Thank you so much. And then for some reason I add, she pooped twice earlier. And this woman, as she's handing me this plastic bag, she looks at me and goes,
I don't give a freaking fuck.
So then she waits to watch me pick up the shit. So I'm leaning over, picking up this mountain of really wet, chunky poop. And this lady is watching. And this corgi is like, I'm worried this dog's fucking dead, to be honest. When
Natasha's sunglasses fall off her face, directly into the large, wet pile of shit that she's been futilely mopping up with her plastic bag.
I know this is going to make me sound like even more of an asshole, but those were such fucking nice sunglasses. They were like vintage sunglasses that I'd gotten new lenses for and all that shit. It was so fucking bad.
Natasha picks up the sunglasses in the same pile as the poop, allowing them to fall into the trash bag as well. Their outline is visible against the plastic.
And this woman, who you fucking know felt so fucking pleased with herself to be seeing this, she looks at me and goes,
it's a beautiful dog.
It's not even fucking mine.
Interior, Bayside High School, day. Raven Baxter, 16, and her best friend Chelsea Daniels, 16, stand by their lockers in the middle of the school day.
But Raven, if I don't get to see this concert, my whole world is going to come crashing down.
Well, I guess we better fasten our seatbelts because it's going to be a bumpy night.
Raven, I mean it. I have enough money for the show, I have my mom's car keys, but I just don't have a map to get all the way to L.A.
Ever heard of Google?
I can't look that up on my computer. My mom will see.
What about the computers in the library?
They're blocked after the time someone looked up Principal Lawler's age.
Why don't we look it up at my house after school?
No way, Raven. Our moms are in cahoots. Cahoots! And anyways, I have to leave in an hour if I want to get there in time. I just wish there could be some sort of message in the sky saying, here's the solution to this problem.
Chelsea, that's it.
What's it?
Mr. Nelson owns a skywriting service.
Yeah?
He can draw arrows in the sky as you drive to show you where to go. You'll even be able to see traffic from above so you can get there in time.
Raven, you're brilliant. Where do we get the money?
Oh, he'll do it for free. Mr. Nelson owes me a favor. Suffice it to say, I gave him a hand when he found himself between a gorilla and a bowl of banana pudding.
Chelsea hugs Raven tightly, elated.
You're the best.
That's what friends are for.
Chelsea runs off. Raven smiles after her. Suddenly she pivots, eyes staring outward. One hand rises, fingers splayed and a stop sign beneath her chin. We pull in close to her eye, then zoom in, through her pupil. Cut to interior, bookstore cafe, day, where Haley, the actress from the horror movie, stands over a bald man's table. She holds the empty paper cup upside down over his head. He's soaking wet with burning hot coffee, moaning quietly.
You shit-headed motherfucker!
Back to interior, Bayside High School. Raven unfreezes and walks slowly out of frame, baffled. We hear a loud plunk, the rattling of metal. Cut to exterior, Runyon Range, 2 p.m. A dusty, wood-gated expanse with a small woodshed and an archery range. The whole place is empty except for Olivia, who shoots at a line of tin cans with a BB gun. She speaks in voiceover as she shoots.
I am always moving, one thing to the next, and the next, and the next. The idea is to keep me in the moment. If I'm in the moment, that is the only place I can be.
She fires. We hear the sound of a BB rattling a can. Plunk.
Except that at this point, I can shoot without even concentrating. I'm not in it anymore, not to the extent I'm supposed to be. Making all these plans makes it so that I can never appreciate anything. There's always something next, and it's pressing. I'm not supposed to get stressed out. I just start feeling anxious when I imagine having nothing to do. On my way here, I thought of something.
She lowers her gun and sits on a bale of hay. Slowly, she takes off one of her shoes and raises her bare foot out in front of her. She picks up the gun. We assume her POV, looking between the plastic, glassless crosshairs. She aims at the spot where her big toe meets her foot, and then nudges over ever so slightly, so that she's pointing to the air just next to her foot, to exactly what is no longer her foot.
If I can get a perfect graze, I'll be awake to something. I'm tired of always monitoring whether or not I'm gonna be okay, arranging everything so that I'm gonna be okay. Am I okay? Can I get a perfect graze?
She shoots. Nothing happens. The BB misses by a few inches. She didn't even feel the wind rush as it passed by.
I imagine what I would have thought if it had hit me. What words would I have chosen? It all changes. Today you are a woman.
Cut to interior. Lauren's car. 2 p.m. Denny drives. Lauren looks out the window. They're passing through Ukiah, California.
There have been days when I've gone into work when I've been really sick. If I don't go to work, I'll lose something. Sometimes I hear people talking about amounts of money in this way that's like they like the thought of a big number. For me, money is just whatever it buys. Not fun stuff. Fucking tortillas, you know? Detergent. Should I have to pay off? Insurance.
How much do you have in the bank?
Like 700? 724, I'm pretty sure.
We should take all our money out over the course of today. I think you can do 500 at a time.
Is that sketchy?
I mean, yeah, but like, they're gonna be monitoring our account soon. You should have the cash.
She's right. Danny's heart sinks as once again, for the 10th time today, it strikes her how fucking harebrained this plan is. How absolutely fucked they are. That even if they were to turn the car around and go back to the bar and call the cops, it would already be suspicious. They'd do an autopsy and they'd find that Richie'd been dead since the previous day. They'd have no excuse for not calling. She's ruined her life. She's ruined her life, maybe forever. She needs to put it out of her mind.
How much money do you have?
Like 13 grand, I think.
What? You have $13,000 and you did this?
It's not that much.
That is more than 13 times what I have. I wouldn't have done this if I had $13,000.
Well, I guess we're different then. I don't know what to tell you.
Danny feels nauseated. What the fuck is with this bitch?
I got in a car accident last year and hurt someone, so my insurance went way up. He's fine, but my insurance costs a fortune now.
Oh, I'm sorry. My car just died one day earlier this year. That's why I always bike to work. I was driving down Olympic and boom. Car is dead forever.
What'd you do?
I got a bike. I ride that everywhere now. Not too bad. Mainly just cuts into my time. I moved to LA to try and be a screenwriter. I haven't written anything since I got here.
You moved to LA to be a screenwriter?
Yeah. I always liked writing, and I had this teacher in high school who kept telling me to do it. So I listened to her, and I moved, and my mom was so fucking supportive of me, even though I knew I could have given her a hand at home. I signed up for these classes, but then I didn't have time.
Fuck. She looks up, through the curve of the windshield, where it goes dark blue, remembering her drive from Salt Lake City to LA, how she kept finding herself looking at that dark blue edge. Her eyes are close to welling up with tears.
Would you want to get piercings?
What?
just pass a tattoo parlor. Let's get piercings. Let's vibe with what this means to us right now. We'll worry later.
Danny finds herself pulling over without having decided to.
Yeah.
Cut to interior tattoo parlor a moment later. A rather large, completely empty one-room tattoo parlor with psychedelic patterns painted on the walls. A gauzy folding screen blocks off the back third of the room. Danny has a strange sense of herself and Lauren as a team, a unit, alone together right now in this empty tattoo parlor.
Hello?
From behind the screen.
Just a sec, please. I just need to settle something. I'm just gathering some things I've been exploring this morning. Shoot. Oh well.
From behind the screen emerges the wholly unexpected figure of Gwendolyn Orlaith, 30. She's a small, incredibly muscular woman in a t-shirt and baggy pants, with a cue-bald head and ear gauges the size of fists. Her arms are covered with tattoos, and the rest of her body is covered in piercings. Not one, but three rings of ascending sizes hang from her septum. She holds a string of turquoise beads.
You guys want to hear a crazy story?
Hi?
It's about these string of beads. It's the craziest thing. A friend of mine makes a pilgrimage every so often to Sedona, you know, Arizona. And she got me these beads there a couple years ago at a trading post. Said she saw my spirit in them immediately. And when she got back from her trip, when she was going to bring them to me, she looked all around and realized they'd disappeared. So she came over and told me what happened, and we didn't know what it meant. Oh no, Gwenny, what's gonna happen to your soul if the string's missing? A little while later, she goes back to her cabin. First thing she sees, right on the kitchen counter. They'd been sitting there.
She shakes the beads on their string.
Isn't that the most incredible coincidence? We couldn't believe it. We both knew that this string of beads was really meant for me.
Had other people been in the house in the meantime?
What's that? Oh, no. No one had been there.
Danny tries to catch Lauren's eye, but Lauren is looking at jewelry.
Although I have to say, life is full of coincidences like that. If you're looking for them.
Yeah. I guess you shouldn't have to look very hard for coincidences like that.
So what can I do for you, sisters?
She wants to get a piercing.
We both want to get piercings.
Maybe.
I want... what's this called?
She points to the small, triangular protrusion of cartilage where her cheek becomes her ear, covering the opening.
That's your tragus. Good choice. There's a lot I love about that one. You know what jewelry you want?
I was looking at this copper ring here. The little one.
Gwendolyn hunches down over the display case.
Oh. Oh, wow.
She looks up at Lauren with wide eyes.
Yeah, I see that for you. That's not copper, though, my friend. That's rose gold.
I want it.
Let me see it.
Danny leans over the case and takes a look. It's a tiny, rich-hued ring whose color is indeed unplaceable. Red by some light, brown from another angle, amber from a third. Now that it's been called to her attention, it stands out.
A rose gold ring for a tragus piercing. You must be quite an individual. You know, what they say about rose gold is right. I've been trying and trying to avoid it, but they got to me. And you?
I'll be the same, actually.
Gwen freezes. She looks back and forth from Danny to Lauren.
What does it mean?
Cut to interior, tattoo parlor, a few minutes later. Danny and Lauren stand at the register with matching rose gold rings through their respective tray guy.
I've got this. Seriously, I actually insist. Let me get cash.
There's an ATM in the back.
Wait, Lauren.
They make eye contact.
I'll come back with you.
They pass behind the screen again and huddle at the ATM.
Don't use your card here. The withdrawal will come up.
I want it to. Look, at a bank they have cameras. Here they just have Gwen. No one would ever take her testimony seriously. She's probably high right now.
She just pierced us.
She's still probably high right now. It's a fake out, Danny. They'll think we took the 101 all the way up, but really we'll turn around and then take the 101 down to the 29 and then all the way to the 80. Or something.
Okay.
She walks back to the front of the tattoo parlor and looks around at the walls, stopping at a photo of an elderly man who stands gazing up at a tree. No, he's not standing. His feet are a few inches off the ground. He's being held up by two massive hooks that have been inserted through enormous perforations in his chest, two holes on each side in a line, above and below his pectorals.
Is that a real picture?
Oh yeah.
Gwen nods.
So you have those huge piercings through your breasts?
Uh-huh. You know, there's evidence to suggest that humans have been participating in hook-pull rituals for 5,000 years.
Lauren re-enters, cash in hand.
It's a beautiful experience. I first participated when I was 26 years old. Man, the first time I did it, it's the closest I've ever felt to God.
Lauren passes Gwendolyn the money, and Danny takes one last look at the photograph, scrutinizing the old man's face, which indeed looks positively enlightened as he dangles on his hooks, stuck above the ground. Cut to exterior, Libby's backyard, afternoon. The gorgeous, multi-tiered backyard of the Ames family compound, replete with a fire pit, a swimming pool, ping pong, and a small hiking trail that winds off from an outdoor table. At this table are Olivia, Scout, and Libby herself. The three old friends enjoy the afternoon shade. It really gets to me, at a certain point, when I hear people calling me out, like dumb bloggers and shit, saying that I'm a sellout, and that making art that I profit from is somehow dirtying my work. I'm just like, I have to make a living. The ideal that people have about artists being broke but also so brilliant that they're just able to, like, make it work somehow, it's made up.
I don't know. I think it's kind of fair to hope that people have to work for it a little.
I do.
I do. I'm sorry. Are we not asking our opinions on that? You're just putting that out there so that you just nod and say you're right? Because you can't, like, just volunteer your opinion and then not want to talk about it.
Whoa. What's your deal? Are you saying that I'm not working for it?
She was trying to speak honestly about her experience.
No, Libby, I'm sorry. That's not what I'm saying. I'm sorry.
Should kind of mean it, though. Honestly, fuck Libby right now. Like, is she hearing herself right now? She's embarrassing herself. I work really fucking hard, Olivia. I don't know why you think it's acceptable to say that to me. Especially today. Are you kidding me? It's actually, thinking about it, totally bogus. Like, if I'd spent the past 5 years working on becoming a master mechanic and had finally settled into a steady income at this point, you'd be congratulating me.
Yeah, it'd be a pretty different road to getting there if you were becoming a master mechanic right now.
Are you really saying that what I make isn't worth the time I'm spending on it? Olivia, that is so fucking hurtful. And also blatantly fucking hypocritical. How far were you expecting this conversation to go before it comes up that you're a fucking actress living exclusively off your parents' money? Come on. Which one of us is financially independent right now? Why the fuck would you say that to me? Especially today.
I think she really meant...
No, Scout, stop. Really, why would you say that to me? You have no ground to stand on in what you have just said to me. I figured out what I love to do, and I found a way to live off of it. Good for me. You think people were asking for a bunch of fucking ballads played on a lute by a 22-year-old woman in 2006? I made this space for myself. I fought really hard for it. That's something I should be proud of, not embarrassed about. If I were a man, everyone would be fucking high-fiving me for what I've accomplished. Root for me, Olivia. As a woman, but also as my fucking friend. Especially tonight. A beat as Olivia falls silent. Libby looks at her unflinchingly and watches as her eyes drop to the slatted wood boards of the patio, failing at this moment to hide the suffering that has couched itself in other sentiments for so long. And now Libby reminds herself of the incredible fractures that Olivia sustained and how she, Libby, having known her through them, has promised to be there for her, and wants to, and needs to, feels it to be part of who she is and the goodness that she wants to bring to the world, which makes it a part of herself that she loves and would never want to lose. How much is it really worth to stand up for yourself to someone who's only hurting you out of her own pain? Is it just convenient to believe in this culture of every man for himself and push other people to take their own responsibilities and try to get every individual to want to be the perfect person that we know they'll never be? Could it instead be time to meet people only ever with love and forgiveness? Will it work? Her phone buzzes. She opens it. Fuck, they're here. I've got to get them. Olivia, on my own end, I'm really sorry. I just said a bunch of shit that I hadn't thought through, and I'm, like, already regretting a lot of it. This seems like a conversation we need to have, but after my gig, because I'm allowed to be excited for it. Is that okay? Are we good?
Yeah, we're fine.
They make eye contact.
I feel the same way too, so we're fine. I'm sorry too.
Okay.
She turns and exits. We follow her into interior Ames House continuous. The inside of the family house is as charming as the outside. Pots hang from hooks above the kitchen stove, colorful cartoons line the hallways, rugs with tastefully hallucinogenic patterns top the tiles. A defunct dumbwaiter has its small door open, revealing a trove of statuettes from all over the world. Libby stops one more time at the mirror on the way to the foyer. She looks pretty. This is it, she's realizing. As of today, she's become exactly who she's always wanted to be. Everything she's ever been waiting for is starting in 1 second. What comes next? She walks on light feet to the foyer door and takes a look through the eye hole. And now, in fisheye, we see, for the first time, in all their glory, the young members of Square Circle, the band without a sound, eventual icons of aught-era indie rock, catalysts of history. On the far left is Spencer Savard, 22, multi-instrumentalist and one of the band's two lead songwriters, a hot-as-shit, angel-faced bad boy who your mother would hate even if his ballads made her weep in quiet recognition. Then the other lead songwriter, Nick Crandall, 23, our stoic, tortured heartthrob, whose own mysterious heart has fixated itself on our favorite young folk singer. Beside him is Jacob Overman, 23, the band's puckish bassist and self-appointed conceptual director. And finally, on the far right is Bill Bright, 22, virtuoso drummer and stand-up guy, behind whose deep, soulful eyes and quiet voice lies an intellect of extreme, though humble, grace. He wears a Lakers jersey. Again.
I'm Spencer.
I'm Nick.
I'm Jacob.
I'm Bill.
And we're Square Circle. Libby opens the door for them, beaming.
Well, look who it is.
Hey.
So this is Laurel Canyon.
Oh my god, Bill, repping the Lakers.
I'm a local now, so...
Who's on the back? Kobe, duh. Come on out back, guys.
Libby, this place is so beautiful.
Thanks, Bill. My childhood home. I'm super lucky. Alrighty, here's the backyard.
Jesus.
Ah, guys, ladies, meet my dudes. Dudes, meet my ladies. Scout and Olivia are two of my three oldest friends in the world. And Scouts, your chauffeur tonight. Be nice to them. I'm looking at you, Spencer.
I don't know what you're talking about.
Guys, I'm going in for the hugs.
This is so crazy. My two worlds colliding. Come sit.
So you guys just got to LA?
Yep, on Friday.
Oh, so you're here for a while, yeah?
Yes, for a really long time.
I do like it here. Yeah, I'm getting into it, although I feel like I have a lot of misconceptions about it. Bill thinks everyone he meets here is an actor.
Well, there's one in your midst.
Yeah, Olivia just wrapped a movie tonight, actually.
Liv, you never said how that went.
Oh, well, yeah, I wasn't going to say anything, but I actually walked off the set.
What?
Wasn't it the last day of filming?
Yeah, it was. But, they threw me a curveball.
Cut to interior set, 11 a.m. Olivia stands in a bloody nightgown, holding a stuffed bunny, speaking with her directors, Zeke Silverman and Willie Blau, as her co-star, Leia Epstein, stands by.
I'm not fucking doing that.
What do you mean?
I mean, I'm not fucking doing that. I'm not going to start dripping while I'm getting eaten alive by my fucking demented sister.
Or are you the demented one? See, that's the question this scene raises.
I'm not doing it. It didn't say anything about this in the script.
I mean, it was in the subtext.
Do you have any sense of how fucking sick this is? I mean, not just the scene you're filming, the position you're putting me in. You blatantly kept this from me. This is basically porn.
Or art.
Or are you a bunch of fucking dipshits? You too, Leia.
Hey, what the fuck?
I quit. You guys are scumbags. I don't care if you fucking pay me.
She heads to the door.
Hey, You're a fucking cunt. You hear me? You're a fucking cunt.
You are a cunt.
Back to exterior. Libby's backyard.
Olivia, I have no idea. Why didn't you end this earlier?
I don't know. I'm still kind of pissed about it, I guess. I wasted 3 weeks on that bullshit.
So you're not getting paid?
I don't think so. I don't give a fuck. There's barely any money anyway.
You should still take it. As a last, like, fuck you.
I think I just want to be done with dealing with those people.
Is that really that bad, though?
Nick! Yes.
I mean, I guess I'm just wondering, isn't that kind of what acting is?
You mean suddenly being coerced into making a scene totally like, one, two, three, depraved and gratuitously objectifying?
What the fuck? How do we both just think of that?
You're right. Sorry for saying that.
It's okay.
Guys, I think I just need to head home to nap a little bit before tonight. I was up crazy early.
Ah, bummer.
Really?
Yeah, I was up crazy early.
You had a nutty day, too.
Okay.
See you guys tonight. Bye, Liv.
Think about my dressing room before the show?
Oh, for sure. Okay, see ya.
Scout, let's bring these guys beer.
I can help.
That's all right. Scout?
For sure.
They rise, passing into interior, Libby's kitchen, continuous.
I actually just don't know what to do. Honestly, I don't even know how much I want her backstage tonight.
Why'd you invite her then?
Because Olivia waits for me to do things she can hold against me.
I don't think that's what it is.
It is. It totally is. And then she does the shit where she sentimentalizes our childhood and is like, I just miss it the way it was then, and I'm like, it was high school. I'm glad it doesn't feel like high school anymore.
But, like, think about it.
No, I get it. Things are different for her. I do get it. But tonight is the biggest, most emotional night of my life. Ever. Or potentially, at least. And she's fucking making me feel bad about myself beforehand? Why is that okay?
Yeah.
And can I just say that it really hurts that she just left after talking to Nick for, like, 1 minute? She's my oldest friend in the world, and she's meeting the man I'm falling in love with. I'm in love with him. I'm in love with him. I'm like, this guy's, I've never felt like this before. Not like this.
I can tell. That's amazing. It's amazing to see.
Libby laughs, shaking her head. Her eyes are full of tears.
So fucking weird.
I'm really happy for you.
Happy for me too.
Intermission. I'll bring out some cookies for everybody. And more wine.
Prologue. Most cases of expose journalism begin with innocuous accidents. A writer comes into a piece of information that sticks ever so partially out of the dirt, and at first she ignores it completely, not recognizing it for what it really is.
Cut to exterior, open road, evening. A fast-moving wide-angle shot of a desert road.
The story I'm about to tell does not begin that way. The event that precipitated this particular journey was not innocuous, and it was not an accident.
Cut to interior. Starbucks at Barnes & Noble, 10 a.m. Maya stands in a short line at the cafe counter.
It was a Tuesday morning in 2006. The previous week, I'd interviewed the folk singer Libby Ames. That night, I had a ticket to hear her concert. I'd gone out looking for inspiration. I was working then as an arts writer. I liked the work, but it also felt perhaps too safe. I hadn't made my own art since college. I resolved to start consciously trying to incorporate the element of chance in my life. Whenever I had a free day, I'd usually go to a different bookstore, usually a really big chain bookstore, and read passages from books at random. That day, I also wanted coffee.
Maya orders at the counter, inaudibly to us, and then crosses the room as her voiceover continues to talk.
I had already placed my order and was waiting for it by the pickup counter. Suddenly, out of nowhere, a woman across the room,
Haley,
who has had her back turned, suddenly reveals herself holding a steaming cup of coffee with no lid. She makes a beeline across the small cafe, her eyes focused dead ahead of her. At the closest table to the door is a bald-headed middle-aged man reading a newspaper, a cup of tea in front of him. She stops as she reaches him.
You motherfucking shithead!
She dumps her coffee all over him.
You shitheaded motherfucker!
She turns back to the door and quickly exits.
Everyone stared. The man sat in his seat, moaning and groaning. After a second, he got up and locked himself in the bathroom. The thing is, I'd seen it happen from the perfect angle, as if in slow motion.
Back to close up. Haley's face. A moment earlier. Haley once again stands at the counter, adding sugar to her coffee. She makes a slow-mo swivel, eyes fixating on the wedge of lemon in the bald man's hands. He squeezes once, twice, and yes, a third time, a certain signal. She traverses the room, a dead-eyed delineated path, raising her cup.
You motherfucking shit.
She's barely touched by the coffee. It slaps the man's scalp and floods his right eye socket. Clear brown liquid drips from both eyebrows and the tip of his nose, and as his mouth opens to bellow and moan, his eyes open and recoil in an instant of overwhelming ecstasy.
You shit-headed motherfucker.
Her shoulders lead her forward, her hands pressing flat against the swinging glass door, imprinting red palms, and now she's traversing the street, almost out of sight, and the man is adjusting the crotch of his pants.
I felt like I found what I've been looking for.
Back to? Close up. Maya. Maya quickly runs out the door as well. Cut to? Exterior. Barnes & Noble. A moment later. Maya stands at the intersection known as Media City Center, looking furiously around for Haley. Finally, she spots her on the grassy median, slowing to a jog, to a power walk, and finally to a relaxed, unassuming amble. She only looks around once. Maya races quickly on the parallel sidewalk to keep up with her. As traffic clears, Haley crosses the street into the IKEA parking lot. Maya peeks from behind a mailbox. Zoom in. Haley looks around the parking lot for a moment, finally walking, head lowered, to a beaten-up white Volvo. As soon as Haley's hand is on the door, Maya turns and runs. Cut to interior, Maya's car a little later. In silence, Maya drives a dusty black Honda Civic down a residential street in Glendale, trailing Haley. They pass an ornate entry gate. Bright white in the sun, clearly a relic from LA's glory days, with a word painted across its central arch, Miradero.
I follow her all the way to Brand Library in Glendale. The library is housed on the grounds of one of LA's oldest mansions, a magnificent palatial building in a Saracenic style, Islamic style arches surrounded by a decadent LA landscaping. Commissioned in 1904, it was turned into a library after the owner's death.
Haley Parks. Maya. Exhilarated. Parks a little further down. Cut to, interior, Brand Library, 12 p.m. A wide shot of Haley sitting at a public computer. The inside of the building is cozy Victorian, in contrast to the imposing facade. We pan. Maya sits across the room at another computer, discreetly watching Haley, who's on the phone.
Hi there, I'm, Haley. I saw your listing and I was interested in speaking with you. Yeah, totally. Oh, definitely. Yes, I'm only 22. Some people would say it was blonde, some people would say it was brown. I'd say it's both or either one. I don't have any pictures. I'm on a library computer. Look, I'll go there and then you can decide. Right now, right this second.
She runs out. Maya creeps to her computer. She left her window open in Internet Explorer. Close up, Craigslist advertisement.
Hot young actress wanted urgently for a scene in bold independent film. Must pass for 18 years old. Must have the body. $300 in cash available. Must be able to film scene by 1 p.m. today. And then below that is an address.
Cut to exterior. Valley Village Street. 12:30 p.m. Maya pulls to a stop, parking. Down the street, Haley looks at house numbers until she finds her door. Exterior. Valley Village Street. 1 p.m. The sun has returned. Maya watches as Haley exits the house, covered in what is obviously fake blood. Haley walks to her car. Maya's voiceover continues.
I never fully relinquished myself to another person. I followed her for an entire day. At first, I thought that I was just trying to live in someone else's shoes.
Cut to interior, Patty's Diner, 1:30 p.m. Haley, wearing a jacket to cover her bloody outfit, sits at a corner table, eating a tuna melt.
We pan to the opposite side of the room, where Maya sits, eating a tuna melt. I thought about what she must be feeling, how she must have gotten there. I wondered if she knew how beautiful she was. My guess was yes. It was a fun exercise, but then something happened.
Cut to interior. Maya's car. 2:30 p.m. Maya parks on a beautiful residential street in the Hollywood Hills, watching Haley walking up ahead. She quietly exits her car and follows. Haley reaches an intersection of many driveways and pauses, looking around, confused. After another moment, she walks decisively, disappears into a wall. Maya races forward to where Haley vanished.
A part of me believed for a moment that I'd been following a ghost. She was in a bloody dress, after all. But no.
Maya realizes that Haley's ascending a rather narrow cement staircase tucked between two garages.
In his 2009 walking guide, Secret Stairs, Charles Fleming describes a semi-secret network of public staircases that lace the hillsides of certain Los Angeles neighborhoods.
Maya begins to make her way up the staircase, slowly, so that Haley still can't see her.
The staircases themselves are historical reminders of a time when Los Angeles was not a city of cars. The city at that time as well, served by trolleys, streetcars, buses, and light rail systems. The trolleys and streetcars are gone, but the staircases remain.
A massive, gorgeous tower in early Hollywood European style rises into view. The staircase passes right by it. As Maya passes, she looks through one of the tower's large windows. It's an elevator tower, which looks like it hasn't changed a bit since 1920.
Keys to the elevator, apparently, are restricted. The only people granted access are residents of the neighborhood above.
The staircase flattens out into a sidewalk. Maya has found herself on a small residential block, accessible only by footpath. Every house is a vintage gem. Haley stops, finally, at a pretty Spanish-style duplex. Maya ducks behind a wall, peering around the corner. Zoom in. Haley takes a deep breath and knocks on the door. After a moment, it opens a crack.
The ring is sealed and the citrus is yellow.
The door swings open and Haley enters, an apprehensive look on her face. We pan back to Maya, who watches, transfixed.
Cut to...
Same place, later. Maya sits where she was previously standing. The light is beginning to look more like evening.
I waited and waited, but she didn't seem to be going anywhere.
Cut to... Entrance to Secret Stairs, 4:55 p.m.
I gave up at a certain point. I was disappointed in a way.
Maya unlocks her car and climbs in.
Starts it up. But I was also exhausted. Voyeurism is neither for the faint of heart nor the weak of foot. I needed to rest for a second. I still had a concert to catch.
Cut to... Exterior. Libby's house. 5 p.m. Libby sits in her car, watching as Nick approaches with the jacket and all the things she'll need tonight. She sees him, in this moment, in the way she first saw him. His rugged sweetness, that mysterious smile. It's his gentleness that gets her. The sincerity in his gaze as he looks at her, that he wants to protect her not because she can't do it for herself, but because he cares about her, because she cares so deeply for him too. Sucking on the head of his cock, sucking all of it, he listens to her, thinks that she's wise, tells her so, and then he has a drill that he knows how to use. He can't help but know when she invites him. How yesterday she sat on him facing outward, sun catching on the windowsill, and he licked her on the back, kissing her shoulder blades, hands at her breasts. His ass, his adorable, accidental ass. His flat, hard chest, dark-nippled, still boyish, skin smooth. His thin legs, his flat feet, the stubble on his chin where it turns into his lips, and then his tongue, and then his teeth, flicking her clit, lingering on it. He gets in the car.
You've got everything?
Yeah. They kiss.
Libby raises her hand to start the car.
You're sure you're not going to be bored just waiting around? Because Scout's coming back in an hour to get the others.
You, like, not want me to go with you?
I really want you to come with me. I just don't want you to if you don't want to.
I really want to.
They kiss again.
Good. It's settled.
They make out.
Finally, they part, and Libby starts the car.
You seem calm.
I seem calm. Somewhere deep down, I'm flipping a fucking shit.
Cut to exterior, Hightower Loop, 5 p.m. Olivia walks alone down a beautiful... Wait, sorry, I fucked up my cue. Olivia walks alone down a beautiful residential street in the Hollywood Hills, taking a second for herself. The afternoon is quiet. The road dead ends suddenly, giving way to a paved staircase. Olivia climbs the stairs. The camera sinks nearly to the level of the ground and begins to lead the way up, past an old elevator tower, to a quiet, leafy neighborhood that's only accessible by foot. Olivia follows the narrow sidewalk in the afternoon light. The air feels completely still. We continue to follow the path as she speaks in voiceover.
These moments once meant something so different to me. I noticed different things about this place. When I was younger, I would get a sense of a place and then somehow could preserve it forever so that every time I went back, it held on to its same initial character. There was always something refreshing about the seclusion of this place. I was consistently able to find peace here. I thought it would always feel that way. Now the feeling is something I can look at. I can feel it to the extent that I recall it, but it isn't here anymore. I came here in the rain once. I definitely came here with Scout and Natasha once, and with Libby a couple of times. It's weird when I remember those times. I'm in the frame too, somehow. We're so fucking self-conscious then, but it looks so sort of pure in hindsight. We didn't really know there was a future then. We didn't feel like we'd experienced our own futures yet. Now we live for the future alone. Is there such thing as compassion without a present?
Cut to interior, Scout's mom's car. Same time. Scout sits in the car at a stoplight, gazing off into the distance. She listens to Girl Talk's Night Rippers and finds it to be dictating the patterns of her thought. We zoom in close on her face as she thinks to herself,
I kind of feel like I'm in a bunch of places at the same time.
Suddenly she feels trapped. She considers her sightline, a bougainvillea and a poster of a baby wearing lederhosen. Incoherence violates your senses once and then again and again and again and again. Brutality that keeps you moving at the same time. A lemon wedge, a lemon rind, a cup of lemon brine. Half of it is grave, half of it is play. Maybe it's okay, a funhouse mirror of an oversaturated age. Cut to offices of Bridget Hughes Stern, 5 p.m. Natasha sits at the same desk as before, playing Tetris on her sidekick. The phone jingles, the sound of someone at the door.
Offices of Bridget Hughes Stern. Oh, hey, I'll get the door.
We follow her across the room to the front door. Natasha opens it, revealing Raven Simone, 20.
Oh, look what the cat dragged in.
Hey. So I have your ticket.
Thank you. Yay, I'm so excited.
I'll buzz Bridget. Let her know you're here.
No need.
We turn, revealing the imposing figure of Bridget Hughes Stern, mid-50s, a woman whose grandness of presence says everything about why she's so venerated and so reviled. Bridget can bulldoze mountains for people on her team, but if you're her opponent, she'll bulldoze you. Seeing Raven, she smiles and extends a hand.
Come in, Raven. No time for chit-chat, even if it is about Ross Perloff. Never doubt my omniscience, hon. Let's fire up that Nespresso, yes?
They disappear into her office. Natasha sticks out her tongue. Cut to interior. Bridget's personal office. A little later. A massive office that looks almost like the living room of a home, with a small fireplace, a kitchenette, and a door leading out to a private patio. The women drink cappuccinos.
Raven, I'm not gonna lie. I feel for you. Rebranding is very, very difficult for someone in your position. And I'm just glad you're not taking the slut route like your predecessors.
I'm starting to understand more and more why they do it, though. I'm sort of at the end of my rope. I met with my agent last week, and the scripts they gave me...
Garbage?
The scripts are great. The scripts are fine. I just... In every single one, my parts had the same lines. You got this, girlfriend. Oh, he ain't worth it anyway. Girl, what's the matter with you? You know what it is, Bridget? That character exists at age 20 and 30 and 50 and 70. I want this show to end so fucking badly, but I also had this realization at the beginning of the season that Raven might be the best character I ever get to play. At least she sometimes gets problems of her own.
You speak too ill of that show, Raven. It's an amazing showcase for you. They let you be a star.
Yeah, for the first and last time.
So let's talk about branding. Let's talk about what you can do.
I think I should just try and make it clear I'm an adult and that they can't pigeonhole me. You know, I'm going to that concert Natasha invited me to, her folk singer friend, because I want to see what that scene is like. I want to do something unexpected. I've been thinking I should try to go art house.
That, Raven, is an absolutely terrible idea. There's no money there.
I don't need money. I don't ever need to work ever again in my life.
I don't even understand what you are trying to find.
She looks out the window ponderously. Suddenly she freezes. One hand raised, fingers splayed, eyes wide open. We zoom in through one eye into interior, living room, afternoon. A small, pretty, sunlit living room that Raven has never seen before. A young woman with a troubled expression on her face, Lauren Tillman, speaks to someone out of view.
I don't know how I made such a huge mistake. I don't know what she's gonna do.
She covers her map with her hand, overwhelmed. We zoom back out, through Raven's pupil, finding ourselves back in interior, Bridget's personal office. Raven unfreezes. Jesus fucking Christ, another random one.
Raven?
Yeah, sorry, you asked...
Cut to interior, Victory Bar, 5:30 p.m. The bar is empty and the lights are off. In the evening light, we can see that last night's mess remains as it was.
I asked what you were looking for.
I guess I don't know. I just wish people wanted me to look.
We hear a key turning in the deadbolt and see, out of focus, a darkened figure entering the room. In a moment, she turns on the lights. It's Kendall Chen, mid-20s, a brand new bartender here at Victory. She looks around the red-flooded room, immediately disconcerted by the unstacked chairs and the dirty glasses on a few of the tables. Is setup supposed to include cleanup from last night? There's no way.
Hello, Danny?
That's the name of the girl who's going to be here, right? She notices that the cash box hangs open, empty.
Hello, Richie?
Interior, back hallway, continuous. She's hit with a nauseating stench emanating from Richie's office, whose door is open ajar.
Richie?
She walks slowly, cautiously. She's about to see something. She knows it. She's seen too many movies not to know it. She arrives at Richie's doorway and nudges it open. Looking in, she sees tonight's version of what her coworkers saw last night. Richie's body has bloated and his skin has turned putrid and tough. The vomit in which he lies has formed a soft crust, like bread pudding. The cabinets are all closed. Kendall jumps back.
Fuck. Fuck.
She leans in one more time.
Fuck.
Cut to exterior, Victory Bar, 6:45. Darkness has mostly fallen and caution tape has been set up around the building. Kendall now stands lit by the headlights of cop cars, talking to two male police officers.
So you were given the key to open the bar tonight?
Yeah, they left it for me under the doormat. I thought it was weird that they asked me open because it's my very first shift. A coworker of mine called me yesterday and begged me to do it because she's seeing some concert.
What's her name?
Lauren, I think. I never met her before, so I assume she got my number from Richie.
Where's this concert? Do you know?
I don't think she said. But yeah, she called me and was like, get there at 5:30, you don't have to do anything, Richie won't be there, just chill and sit there by yourself, and another bartender named Danny will be there at 6.
You know, on site, the coroner said Richie's clearly been dead at least 24 hours.
Jared.
What?
That's confidential.
Oh, excuse me.
It's terrible that you repeated that.
Excuse me. Really sorry. Really sorry.
Miss Chen, were you nervous to open up the storefront this evening?
Nervous? No.
You weren't anxious? Uncomfortable?
About what?
I don't know. About that responsibility.
Again, I thought it was weird, but I wasn't nervous. All I was supposed to do was unlock the front door and screw safety nozzles on a couple of bottles. It's not that much responsibility. Also, I've been bartending for close to 5 years now, so...
You've been bartending for 5 years? How is that possible?
What?
How old are you?
How old are you?
26.
You're 26?
Yes.
I would have guessed 19.
That's what I was going to say. 18 or 19.
Whoa.
But I guess that wouldn't have made sense because you need to be of age to be a bartender.
Not in New York.
Sure, but we're not in New York.
Right, no, I know. Obviously, I know. Just, it is possible.
Right, but not here.
Right.
Anyway, Miss Chen, were you at all suspicious when your coworker called you this morning?
Not at all. I had no reason to be.
But you say you were, and I quite weirded out when you entered.
I was weirded out when I saw that no one had cleaned up. I thought the register was open.
But something motivated you to call the cops.
I found my boss's dead body in a giant pool of blood and vomit in his office.
How'd you know he was dead?
His eyes were open and he wasn't blinking. And he was like green and not responding to me.
So you called 911?
Yeah.
Interesting. Then what?
Then you got here.
In the meantime?
In the meantime, I smoked a cigarette out front because I was overwhelmed and I didn't want to be in there.
You know, I've just got to say, that's terrible for your body. As a former addict, I can say that. I know how it is, but I can recommend quitting enough. I can't recommend quitting enough. Or one day you might end up like our friend Richie.
He's right. For a young woman, a 26-year-old woman, the time to quit is now.
Thanks.
Well, Miss Chen, I suggest you go home and focus on other things for the time being. We'll call you if there's any information we might need. And be ready, if need be, to testify.
We strongly suspect foul play, so don't be too surprised.
Jared.
Kendall walks away, out of the spotlights that designate the crime scene. In voiceover...
As I walked to my car, I asked myself how it possibly could have happened that I found myself in yet another situation. I had moved to LA to start something new. I wanted to be done.
Cut to interior. Kendall's car. 7:30. Kendall drives through the darkness. Still in voiceover.
Finally, in the car. I was honest with myself. I could have gone to Philly. I could have gone to Portland. I picked LA. I didn't follow reason, really. I followed my gut. I knew something was coming.
Back to interior. Victory Bar.
See, I wasn't entirely honest with the policeman when they questioned me. I didn't call them right away.
Kendall carefully photographs the bar scene on a small digital camera. She crouches into low, strange contortions, stretches to get bird's eye views. The voiceover continues.
I brought my camera with me to the bar that night. I don't know why I thought I'd need it. Documenting that scene, it weirdly felt like fate. Something about Lauren's call had set off my radar. There was something off about it. When I told the cops I didn't know where the concert was, lie. She said the Orbit. She kept saying the Orbit. Why would she do that? Why would they have me open up on my first night of work? Something was up.
Back to interior, Kendall's car, 7:30 p.m. Kendall sits at a traffic light, which floods our vision of her from red to green.
A new chapter was about to unfold.
Cut to interior, Scout's mom's car, 7:30 p.m. Scout drives down Laurel Canyon Boulevard with Spencer, Jacob, and Bill in tow. Spencer thumbs through a CD book.
Charlie's Angels soundtrack?
Really fucking good.
Charlie's Angels 2 soundtrack?
Also really fucking good.
Now are your mixes? 420.
We missed our moment for that one.
Spontaneously really content.
Haven't listened to that one in a while.
Trying not to poop?
Oh my god, that one's literally just a Jeopardy theme.
Actually, yeah.
Okay, how is it you grew up in Laurel Canyon but don't have any Laurel Canyon music in your car?
I didn't grow up in Laurel Canyon. I grew up in Beechwood Canyon and then West Hollywood, so eat my shorts. B, there's literally a mix in there that's called Laurel Canyon Livin'. That's exactly what we're talking about, so fuck you.
No, I don't see it. Oh, yes I do.
That's right, you bozo.
Yeah.
You know what's weird? Joni Mitchell wrote this song, and hers is the original version of it, but she wasn't even at Woodstock. And then Crosby, Stills, Nash & Young did a cover of it, and they were at Woodstock. And theirs is the bigger version.
Wow, that is really weird.
It's so crazy how, like, right this neighborhood looks for this music.
So you didn't grow up here?
No, I grew up, like, in this mountain range, but further east, and then we moved to West Hollywood when I was 13.
That's very gay of your family.
So gay. No homo, but, like, yeah.
But you knew Libby growing up.
Well, I met her when I started her elementary school in the third grade. Olivia went there, too, Wonderland Elementary. But I wasn't friends with them there, because they were some fucking dumb bitches.
They were really good at handball, and Libby made a really good, really cool paper dress, and Olivia got to play Kim and Bye Bye Birdie while I played the fucking dad, bitches. But then we were all in the middle and high school, all in middle school and high school together. It was combined because it was private and tiny. That's where we met Natasha, and the four of us were like, I was about to say bosom friends.
Bosom bitches.
Were you guys like the hot girls?
Oh no.
You totally were.
No, we really weren't. We were like the alt girls. I mean, our school's pretty alt, actually. I guess we were maybe like the cool girls, maybe, but it never felt like we were the hot girls. I think we were like kind of too smart to be considered hot.
What do you mean?
What do you mean?
You don't think guys like smart girls?
Not in high school. Actually, not out of high school either.
I don't know.
Do you guys really not know what she's talking about?
I mean, I hear angry girls say shit like that all the time. To try to pin the blame on anyone other than themselves for what they can't, for why they can't get dates. But like, no, I don't think it's true. Like, the girls we went to college with were pretty smart, but I fucked a bunch of them.
Nice, Spencer, you're really making a great case.
Libby's really smart, Nick fell for her.
It's not that no man has ever liked a smart woman, it's that seemingly a lot of men are put off by intelligent women overwhelming amount of the time.
Well, that's because a lot of smart women are really manipulative.
As opposed to smart men, God, how is it that you still think you get to make these bold assertions about the way things are?
Yeah, I have to say, it's
you just talk all the time. All the fucking time. Do you understand that most people in the world don't just feel they have full authority on every topic they think of?
Jacob.
No, Spencer, I'm gonna keep calling you out for this until you realize that simply the impulse you have to run your mouth about what life is like for other people is really fucking ignorant, and the only reason you think you can do it is because you're a man. Cut to exterior, the Orbit Theater, 8 p.m. An old Art Deco theater on Wilshire Boulevard with its requisite beautiful neon sign. The marquee is lit up to match. Libby Ames. A crowd mingles in the street. We pan to the front of the line at Will Call, where Haley stands.
Hi.
Name?
Lauren Tillman. ID, please.
She opens her wallet and passes a driver's license under the slot. The ticket taker examines it.
A B.
Finally.
Thank you, Miss Tillman. Enjoy the show.
She gathers her things. We pan quickly to the person in line behind her, Kendall Chan, whose eyes follow her through the Orbit's gracious doors.
Lauren was right where she said she'd be.
Kendall makes her way for the doors, but is stopped by a guard taking tickets.
Hey, do you have a ticket?
I'm in the opening band.
You are?
Yes, I just told your colleague.
She points to another guard standing a few yards away.
Hang on.
Guard number one approaches guard number two. Kendall casually passes through the front door.
Hey, wait, there is no opening act.
But Kendall has disappeared inside. We sweep through, interior, the Orbit, continuous. The jam-packed lobby of the Orbit. We trail Haley, or maybe her name's Lauren, as she wanders aimlessly, freezing as she locks eyes with Maya Sotelo. We pull in on Maya, whose eyes light up. We pan back to Haley, who now quickly turns. Her voiceover resumes.
I never could have guessed I would see her again, and so quickly.
Haley's heart begins to pound. It's the woman she kept seeing this afternoon. Someone's following her. Someone knows something. She races away and we follow her, weaving through the crowd until Scout, Olivia, and Square Circle stand in the center.
Jesus, it feels like everyone we ever fucking met is here.
Natasha comes running over.
Hi.
She hugs Olivia and Scout familiarly, then turns to the band and hugs them one at a time.
Hi, Square Circle. I'm Natasha. I'm really good friends with these guys. I'm kind of really stressed because my boss asked me to meet a client here at the last minute. Raven Simone, actually, is the client. I don't know. So I'm expecting to see her any minute. I don't think I can go backstage, tell Libby I say Mazel Tov, and I love her, duh. And my parents are calling me from outside thinking I have their tickets, even though I don't. So I'm a little distracted from how excited I actually am to meet you, having heard so much about you. But I hope you come to the after party at my house tonight so we can talk.
She runs off.
I like her.
Cut to interior, Orbit bathroom, 9 p.m. Haley stands looking at herself in the mirror. A long beat before a woman, Raven Simone, enters. They make eye contact in the mirror, and Raven can see Haley swivel to watch her pass into the quickest stall she can get to. Holy fucking shit, Haley thinks. She's on the Disney Channel, and instinctively reaches for her purse.
fuck, Raven thinks. The closest stall means the least privacy. There's an uncomfortably wide gap between the stall door and the frame it locks into. From the right angle, one could get a glimpse of her face. And soon she gets her own glimpse of a face, for here is Haley's face in full, then closer, now just a sliver, her eye close up and concentrating. Haley's face is pressed up against the door. She raises her camera phone beneath her face.
Hey, hey!
Another person enters, Maya Sotelo, who stops and stares at what Haley's doing.
Raven rises.
Hey!
Haley turns and screams, recognizing Maya, and runs across the bathroom. Raven slams open the stall door and runs after her, only a few steps behind. She and Maya make quick eye contact, and Maya quickly turns around.
Hey!
Haley swings open the bathroom door, immediately encountering Natasha, who jumps out of the way just in time. Haley runs by without taking another look behind her. In just another moment, Raven runs out of the bathroom, and again Natasha jumps out of the way at the last minute. She's just brought herself back up on her feet when Maya comes racing out of the bathroom as well, this time directly into Natasha, whom she pushes toward the door of the men's bathroom, which opens just in time to reveal Spencer, whom Natasha tackles to the floor. As they fall, they reveal someone else who's been standing there. Kendall Chen, who jumps to join the chase. Haley keeps running, arriving in the main lobby.
Stop her! Stop her!
People have begun to stare. Nick Crandall leans against a wall and speaks to Rob Ames, Libby's brilliant, terrifying father, whom he desperately wants to impress. Suddenly, Mr. Ames falls toward Nick. Haley's knocked him on her way past. Now he and Nick stand sandwiched face to face against the wall until the four ladies pass.
Lauren! Lauren Tillman! Stop that girl!
Bill Bright kneels over in his Lakers jersey, tying his shoe. Haley leapfrogs over him. Raven and then Maya and then Kendall follow quickly behind. Kendall makes a flying leap and catches Raven around the waist. Maya runs headfirst into them both. All three go tumbling to the floor, surrounded now by an audience of everyone in the lobby. Haley slips out. Olivia peers into the circle.
Is that so Raven?
Haley pushes through the front door, running out. She races from under the marquee and ducks beneath a joint being passed between Scout Rutecki and Jacob Overman. Back inside, Raven is crawling to her feet.
What the fuck?
Lauren! Lauren Tillman! Stop her!
With that, she runs down the pathway to the door that Haley blazed. The crowd remains incredibly still. Maya has heard something.
Lauren Tillman?
Raven, her fists clenched, seething, stops herself from running out the door and instead closes her eyes.
Within me is a peacefulness that cannot be disturbed. Within me is a peacefulness that cannot be disturbed.
Cut to exterior, the orbit, same time. Kendall stands outside, looking around at the empty entrance.
Damn it, fuck. I was honestly really pissed. She pretty literally slipped out of my grasp. I was trying to figure out what to do when...
Her phone rings, a number she doesn't recognize.
Kendall Chen.
Hello, Kendall Chen?
Speaking.
Kendall, this is Danny Clark.
Cut to exterior, motel, same time. Danny, in a sweatshirt she didn't have before, stands at a motel payphone in the dead of night.
I work at Victory Bar. I was supposed to be there tonight at the bar, but something happened. You need to help me. You need to find Lauren Tillman.
Tell me everything you know.
But Danny hangs up, her face slackening, her tears never coming, and darts off into the night. Back to Kendall.
Hello? Hello?
Cut to interior, dressing room, same time. A small, crummy dressing room lit in industrial cyan. Libby and Nick make out in front of the mirror. As they separate...
See you after the show, baby.
He's gone. Libby looks at herself at the intersection of the two mirrored walls. She can't see her own face. Everyone she loves is out there. She turns so she can see herself in full, taking a deep breath. She needs to feel calm. It feels like everyone she's ever seen is out there. No time to think. It's time. Cut to interior. Lauren's car. Same time. Lauren drives slowly down a secluded residential street. She's alone now, and has been driving alone for many hours. For so long she's been able to defer her nervous energy. Until now. Back in Los Angeles. For a second there, she wasn't sure she'd make it. She parks her car in front of her final destination, a long staircase leading up to her neighborhood. Victory. Closing the car door quietly behind her, she summons the elevator with her key. And as she rises, she watches the hills and the city shift into a single irregular plane. Her tragus throbs. 2 hours until phase two. The parties in Laurel Canyon. Some rose gold prophecies come true.
Wow. Wow.
Wow.
Wow.
Mm-hmm.
That's great.
Yeah, yeah.
What do you think, Nicholas?
Oh, you know, I found it to be thoroughly engaging. Didn't you? But, you know, full disclosure, I've known Jack for many years, and I would expect nothing less after all the thoroughly engaging conversations we've had at dinners over the years.
Yeah, that's funny. Yeah, I thought that you might have had reason to have run into Jack, actually.
Well, we haven't really run into each other.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't have any personal connection to Jack other than really through knowing him through his work. I went to a similar thing to what happened here at Chin's Push maybe like 2 years ago now, a while ago. And I thought it was a really great thing. Like, instead of producing a performance for people, instead of making people read a script, you know, as a literary exercise, having a small gathering of people where no one is, strictly speaking, a spectator, and then having everyone simultaneously eating and drinking and producing the work for each other as a way of showing this sort of literary venture. I thought that was a really effective way of getting over some of the like hideous natures really of performance work. You know, this terrifying audience and performer dichotomy that, I mean, I know myself in making performance work, I've really always struggled with. So having a situation occur where not only is there sort of an exit point from that posited, but then you also get chicken. Right. And white wine. White wine. Yeah. That's really where I feel like this work really triumphed. Tell me, you know, knowing a little bit about the personal ambiance surrounding Jack and everything, how do you feel about the sort of rendering of the characters and such in the work?
Oh, well, like I said earlier, you know, the tone wasn't too surprising. There's a kind of robust libidinal economy to Jack that, you know, he wears on the surface. So so many of the characters and the narration style were in keeping with that.
No, that's interesting. I felt like in some ways it was very, very truthful. And there are some things that were definitely aimed at a younger audience. Like, you know, the time under discussion in like the early 2000s before iPhones, you know, people have phones, but they're not phones. And it's like the last image of this world before this sort of expulsion from Eden, where the internet's everywhere now, you know, and
prehistory, I think is what they call it.
And people are involved in like the nascent music press. Like there still is sort of like the earliest form of like pitchfork media or something like that exists.
Ooh.
And you know, and this is like an indie music world that I remember well in my life. So it was like a weird thing to see that rendered by someone younger than me. But then there's also the like That's So Raven thing, which was happening at the same time, but, you know, was not a feature of my world in my early 20s. You know, that's not the kind of thing that you're into as a person in those bands would be. So it's like a really weird thing to look back on that period that is both, you know, so close and yet so far. Like, I had just finished my undergrad degree basically when this is set.
I mean, I myself wasn't in an indie band, but I did get the sense of parallax that you're talking about.
Well, it's true. There is no substitute for the wisdom of experience and old age. But that is a good point. That's an interesting way of thinking about that. This has been a longer than usual show, folks. So let's just get on with it and tuck everyone in for the night. Hopefully none of that white wine comes back to sting you guys in the morning. And we'll be seeing you all next week here on K-Chung Radio's The Talking Show. Good morning, Chinatown.